This is the happiness quotient. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy this episode or any episode of the HQ, please be sure to subscribe to me wherever you may be listening. When you subscribe, you'll be notified next time I release another stellar episode with another incredible guest. Today, I have a guest of unimaginable insight and talent with us, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, reporter John Branch of the New York Times, to talk about his new book, Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Backroads of Sports. My friend, Happiness Jones. In 2017, I received a request from today's guest, who I'd never met before, but as you'll find out in the interview, I was well familiar with his work. John Branch, a New York Times sports reporter, not your traditional sports, but rock climbing, skiing, mountaineering, alligator hunting, bowling, wingsuit flying, that kind of sports. As it turns out, sometimes his stories begin for him when someone is killed or dies in pursuit of some lofty goal, whether climbing Everest or skiing deep into the backcountry or side country as it's referred to, or in pursuit of the perfect bowling game. When John first contacted me, he was heading to India to spend time with the families of four Indian climbers who were part of a Mount Everest expedition in 2016. Three men died and a woman survived. Of the three who died, one body was recovered in 2016. The other two bodies were still on Everest at that time, and John was doing a feature on the effort to try and find and recover those bodies, an effort that involved the Indian municipalities, a large sum of money, and the backing of all of the families of those involved. John had learned that I directly encountered these climbers on my summit day, and he wanted to ask about what I saw, or at least remembered, from those encounters. John's story is called Deliverance from 27,000 Feet, an incredible feature which you can find online. John's new book includes this incredible and poignant, often painful, but sympathetic and memorable story. His book is called Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Backroads of Sports. Side Country gathers the best of Branch's work, featuring 20 of his favorite stories from more than 2,000 pieces he's published in the New York Times. It features such classic Branch pieces, including Snowfall, the familiar article that I was talking about downhill skiers caught in an avalanche in Washington State, and Dawn Wall, about rock climbers trying to scale Yosemite's famed El Capitan. In other articles, Branch introduces people whose dedication and decency transcend their sporting lives, including a revered football coach rebuilding his tornado-devastated town in Iowa, and a girls' basketball team in Tennessee that plays on despite never winning a game. The book culminates with his moving personal pieces, including Children of the Cube, about the surprising drama of the Rubik's Cube competitions, as seen through the eyes of Branch's own sports-hating son, and The Girl in the Number 8 Jersey, about a mother killed in the 2017 Las Vegas shooting, whose daughter happens to play on Branch's daughter's soccer team. John Branch has been hailed for writing American portraiture at its best. Side Country is the work of a master reporter at the top of his game. Here is my June 9th, 2021 interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, University of Colorado Boulder grad and Buffalo for life, talking about his third book, Side Country.
John Branch.
Oh my gosh. Tom, how are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
I can. You must be good, able to
good,
hear
good.
Me.
Yeah, I can hear you. I can see that beautiful face.
Oh my
All
goodness.
Good.
Good to see you.
It's nice to see you too. How are you? How's the family? COVID? Is it, are you good, you know?
Consider me among the fortunate ones.
Yeah.
We've all gotten through relatively unscathed. So thank you. I've got two teenagers that have, you know, not been the greatest of years for them, but they're resilient kids.
Yeah.
They're healthy, so we're happy.
It's a shakeup, big time.
It is a shakeup. I don't know who had it worse. Seniors in high school, that was probably rough. But then this year, most of our schools were closed until about a month ago. So then seniors this year actually maybe had it worse because they left their whole senior kind of being from home. It was no fun for anybody, but I think everybody's happy to be here and feeling like a new dawn perhaps is on the horizon.
Yeah, it is. Well,
how are you doing? Hey, I wonder,
good.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just love your whole vibe.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Your show's great. And I love the work you're doing on the Mallory and Irvin front. I hope that's going well. It's fascinating to me.
It is. It's a fascinating story. And I'll tell you something interesting about that is, you know, I had firsthand experience in that going back to 1999, and I didn't really know much about it, but that's really my tie. And some of the people that I talk to, not only the big names, like, if you will, in the Mallory and Irvin mystery, like Jochen Hemleb and Tom Holzell and now Mark Sinnott, there are people out there who are beyond obsessed with the story, and they know way the hell more than I will ever know about it. And so if they want to engage me in a back and forth debate, I'm out. It's like I can't even keep up with them.
Right.
You know?
I thought your conversation with Mark Sinnott was fascinating.
You can probably tell we're pretty good buddies. And he is a smart, smart dude. And he went deep into the book. And, you know, he did it right. And even though it's a different kind of book, I liken it a little bit to Wade Davis's Into the Silence. And that's that. I love that about Mark's book, because he didn't just say the boot from Mallory's foot was in such and such a condition. He went and saw the boot. That's cool. That's really cool. Yeah, but that's kind of one of your hallmarks. I mean, I thought that in a way, you know, you had this opportunity. You could have written a lot of this stuff from afar, but like the bowling story, the guy who did the perfect 300 game, you heard about it and you went to the memorial service. Like, so you're in it.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I'm proud about with these stories is that they're all from on the ground. You know, there's a dateline on all of them. And the past year has been tricky because it's not my cup of tea to be sitting here, as much as I love the idea of Zoom, which has been a great reporter's tool that I've discovered over the past year. But I don't like writing stories or reporting stories from my living room or from my office. And so it's been tricky for this past year. So I'm happily out traveling a little bit again. And I feel like, good, this is what I want to be doing is... As much as I complain about airlines, I'm happy to jump on a plane to go places.
So the book is Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Backroads of Sports. And it says something to be able to put a book like this together by somebody who, if you will, writes articles, because that's a lot of stories about, you know, tales of death and life. So you're not your traditional reporter, which I'd like to ask you about. You're a journalist. You don't write about the New York Yankees unless there's something John Branch-esque about the story, I suppose. But 2,000 plus articles that you had to glean from to find this. Tell me a little bit about that and how you came up with that subtitle to the book, and actually the title too, which I think is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so one at a time. Side country, as you know, I'm sure, is a skiing term. It means the area just beyond the boundaries. And so more and more of these ski areas are opening up their boundary gates to what they call the side country to kind of entice people to this extra terrain. And that's where the story Snowfall took place. The avalanche story was in the side country of an area in Washington called Stevens Pass. And I was always kind of taken by that term. People in the backcountry industry don't love it because it sounds like a safe version of the backcountry. It sounds like backcountry light to them, even though it's just as dangerous. I think there's an element of security when you're in the side country because you think, well, the ski area is right there. This can't be that crazy over here. And so it became in my head a little bit of a metaphor for the kind of work that I like to do and the kind of stories that I like to put in this, or that I did put into this thing. And that is, things are just on the edge, maybe just a little outside the boundaries, but not so far out that we can't relate to them, that we can't feel like we can sort of reach and touch them. Tales of life or death and life.
Crazy,
That's
man.
just a weird little twist. The reason is because a lot of these stories do involve death, but I think there's a spark of hope in most of them that is that element of life. You know, most of these stories are that are about death are about people I never met, and so the stories really are about the people left behind, and so that's where it's death and life as opposed to the other way around. And what was the other part of this question? Oh, how I gleaned or how I came through them.
Yeah, good luck going through
I'm actually happy
2,000
about that.
articles. Yeah.
So it really is off the top of my head. There's no way really to go through our archives and say, you know, what are, you know, type in John's favorite stories. And so I just sat down with a pad and paper and started thinking, what stories stick with me? And came up with a pretty good list of stories that just I've always just sort of held in my heart. Went back then and started to read those stories, and some of them I thought, wow, good, this was a good story. I really like this story, even 6 or 8 years later, whatever it might have been. And several of them, I went back and was disappointed in the way I had done the story. Maybe my taste had changed or something, but I thought, wow, that memory of this story in my head, the reporting of the story was so special. The connections I made with the people were so special. And then I went back and read the story for the first time in years and went, oh, dang it, John. Yeah, you probably could have done that differently or better or something. And so I tossed it out. So I wanted this to be a collection of stories that not only meant something to me pretty deeply, but also that I liked.
I love, actually, one of the coolest parts is the foreword, right? And you're talking about sweating it out down to the deadline, and you almost, close your eyes like and hit send and just go. I mean, that's the difference of being a journalist on a deadline and somebody, not that people who write books with a contract aren't on their own deadline, but that might be, 6 months to come up with a rough draft. You, like if it has to be in at 5 o'clock the night before the article, at 5 o'clock, dude, it's over, right?
I think I called an act of surrender. I never file a story going, you know, this is brilliant. I can't wait to file it. They're gonna love this. I always just kind of have one eye closed and hit the send button and just kind of wave it away and kind of think, let's hope the editor doesn't hate this. And you know, let's hope I get away with another one and that the readers don't see right through me and let's move on.
I'm gonna in the intro to this interview, I'm gonna list the names of a bunch of the stories in it, and but wanna say that back in 2013, I was in an avalanche on Mount Washington. And one of my best friends in the mountains was on a different rope team, and it was horrible. I mean, I for you know for like 6 hours, I thought he was avalanched, and we managed to self-arrest in this avalanche. I thought he was dead, and as well as the other two people on his rope. And it I still I'm literally like chilling remembering that feeling, as even though my fingers were frostbiting at the moment. And it wasn't long after that I came across your article about the avalanche on Stevens Pass. And I literally, I was like, I almost couldn't get through the article. I had like, it was palpable. I was like nauseous reading about the people, tw about 12 people, which was what my group was. Everybody going, maybe we should turn around here. And the way you exposed the details of the story, I literally felt like I could have been in that avalanche right there on Stevens Pass. Three people died on that one. But I was blown away at how, I had a part in an experience like that, but you brought those people to life, especially the people who died in that avalanche.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'm very happy. And again, I write stories and hope that I can kind of get away with you know, my limited knowledge of the subject, frankly, on all these stories, and hope that I've done enough reporting and research and interviewing to pass it off to people like you who know the subjects better than I do, or people who know bowling better than I do, whatever the subject might be, and have them think, oh, you know what, this was accurate, fair, authentic. It was a full portrayal. And I'm happy with the snowfall piece, especially because I've gotten a lot of nice words from people who have been in avalanches. I know the story is still used in some avalanche safety courses. Mm. And then, you know, I don't necessarily go looking for those kind of bona fides, but I'll take them if the story feels like it hit the right mark. And
yeah,
let's take that nice compliment.
Yeah. So, there were some stories that crossed over and were part of your life. The the girl in the number 8 jersey. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I think I got the name of the article correct.
Yeah, you did. And it's weird because of those 2,000 stories, there's probably 3 or 4 that actually have me in them. And amazing. I think 3 of them are in this book now. I'm not one of those that likes to put myself into the stories. And that one was just one on when I got a phone call in the middle of the night from editors saying there's been a mass shooting in Las Vegas late last night. Can you get to Las Vegas right now? And I said, yeah. So I hustled to the airport and got to Las Vegas. And when I got there and I checked into the Mandalay Bay, and I was actually in a suite just a few floors below where the killer was. So I was in this room that was exactly the same view that he had 12 hours earlier. And my wife texted me and said, Stacy Etchever, who's the mother of one of the girls on my daughter's soccer team, was there last night and they can't find her. Wow. And so, you know, by nightfall that first day, 24 hours after the shooting, they found her in a morgue, and her husband did. And so my community back here in California was going through all the familiar mourning exercises that have become sort of familiar to people all around the country after a shooting. There were the memorials, there were the vigils, the candlelights, the giant pile of teddy bears and roses and flowers. People like my daughter and my mom or my wife hung ribbons all around town, orange ribbons for her. Meanwhile, I was in Las Vegas covering this. I couldn't have been any closer to the scene for a week. And the real story, the heart story, was back here at home, and my own family was experiencing it in ways that I was not. And so it wasn't until I got home a week later and got home just in time purposely to be at my daughter's soccer game. It was the first soccer game since this had happened. And the little girl whose mom had been killed showed up, and all the parents were kind of amazed. And one of the moms had brought ribbons for all the girls, and they bought orange socks for the girls and orange knee pads and little wristbands. And the girl played, and her family, the woman's parents and husband were all there on the sideline. And it's just a girl soccer game, 12-year-old girls. And the girl scored the winning goal on a breakaway that I'll never forget. And I just about collapsed in tears. All this emotion I'd had for the past week being this hardened journalist in Las Vegas covering this thing just melted. And I didn't know what to do with myself. It rocked me for a couple of days. And I sat down and just wrote a Facebook post. So that story you read was really a Facebook post. My wife said, what are you doing? And I said, I just need to get this out. And I put it on Facebook. And my wife was nervous about what the community might say about it. And an editor at the time saw it, because we're Facebook friends, and said, can we publish this in the Times? And I said, yeah, sure. And so they put it on the front page of the Times. So in a weird way, it tells me that I should write all my stories as Facebook posts.
Because you can edit them.
Yeah, edit them. And maybe it's just that my mind isn't, thinking this is a story. It's just, I'm just letting it out. So yeah, that one means a lot to me. And there's a reason why it's the last story in the collection, because it hits me especially hard.
So that's you're like any writer, It's not always, well, it's at least for you, you even said it's, I try not to insert myself into a story. And that one, obviously, you were in some respects in the middle of it or in the heart of it. Where did you in your growing up or realize that this was some, like some people express themselves like with music or art or hiking or something. And here you are, a writer.
Right.
It's pretty cool.
It took me a while. I didn't come to this until I was in my late 30s. Huh. I was a manager at Costco through most of my 20s and was a kid who grew up as a sports fan. One of those kids that loved the newspaper, loved going to the box scores. My friends, when I was a kid, said, you should be a sportscaster someday. But I just didn't follow that little tickle in the back of my head for 10 years. Went and got a business degree instead. And, at some point kind of said, you know what? I love my job at Costco. I still love Costco actually to this day. They were very good to me. But I thought this is not what I want to grow old doing. I don't think. I think I'll kick myself if I don't try something else. And so I went back to journalism school and just got a degree, a master's degree in journalism. I had not written really before other than English papers. I'd never written for the school paper or anything like that. But I thought I had a pretty good sense of what this job entailed. I thought I'd read enough newspapers to maybe I could figure that out. And it was kind of blind luck. I'm glad I took that risk. I didn't have kids at the time. And I had the support of my wife. And, you know, who knows what would have happened if I would have had kids or if life circumstances would have been different.
Yeah, well, that's an interest. To me, that's why I'm fascinated with people is... I always feel like whenever I have a conversation, whether it's here or in casual, like hiking on a trail or meeting somebody at a gathering, I'm so fascinated by what makes people tick and what always blows my mind, not really, but what always fascinates me kind of on the head scratcher is how can people not have something in their heart that they desire and love and not go after it. I get it. Sometimes you have kids, it's not practical. And you know, sometimes there's not the financial means or whatever, but like I was just almost reckless in my pursuit of things that I wanted. And I'm not saying that, I'm not exaggerating. Like it wasn't pretty all the time. I was like, I'm not going to frickin' sit behind this desk editing 60 or 70 hours a week for a dude who runs a company producing frickin' videos about how to sell, you know, shirts. I literally did that, you know. And that was cool. I learned a lot. But it's like, so you followed your dream. And that's cool. You still, like, kudos to Costco. But that wasn't your heart's desire.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is, there's maybe if you go really deep, there's probably a theme here. People keep reminding me that I keep writing about death. But I think there was a worry in the back of my head, like, you know, you look at obituaries, or at least obituaries in the papers back 20 years ago, where they would have the person's name, age, and their profession. Mm-hmm. And I thought, is mine going to say, you know, John Branch, 72, retail manager? I'm like, is that what I want to be? A retail manager? Mm-hmm. Right. So I thought, I don't think that's what I want my epitaph to be.
Yeah. I saw a video. This is an interesting trajectory because this really, I guess maybe it is about the book in some way. But I saw a video completely coincidentally yesterday about this guy who had emigrated to Poland. And then he's an American guy who lives in Poland. And this video, it was like a TED Talk or something. It was like, what do you want to think of the day before you die? And it was fascinating. And he was kind of not like the greatest public speaker, but it was about, and he was peeling away the layers of what's really important. And that's kind of the heart of a lot of your stories is because when somebody dies, even if it's only for a crystal moment, like a pinpoint of a moment for many people, at least there's that crystal clear understanding of what matters in life. And a lot of times people go back to their same old stuff. But that's kind of the cool thing about death. It's like I want you to talk, but I'm just sharing this in a way. But it's like, I remember like when my mom died, like, and this is, you know, 2016, I still hadn't decided if I was going to go to Everest or not. In literally the moments of her death, it was like I saw in brilliant clarity, like, what it was all about. Now, I'm not saying that I do now, but I was out. Here's my globe of experience, and I'm seeing it all from inside. Somebody dies, and you go, and you pop out, and suddenly you're looking. That's cool, man. And that's why I'm so glad you wrote Tales of Death and Life in that order.
Yeah, well, thanks. So, yeah. I mean, to your point, I'm fascinated by, obviously, anybody who dies that's close to you, that changes your life for the rest of your life, and yeah, maybe in ways that you don't recognize. And so I do like the idea that these stories are really about the people who are left behind. And it'd be interesting in some ways to go back, you know, to some of these stories that maybe were 3 or 4 years ago or 10 years ago, and really figure out, you know, now with hindsight, how did that moment affect you? How did it really change you? How did your perspective of life change from that moment? Because some of these were so raw that people maybe didn't have that perspective at the time. Mm. It changed their life, for sure, but it was more of a sudden, you know, shaking of their life. And now after a few years, maybe, you know, like with your mother, after 5 years, your perspective of the impact of that moment, it might be different. This is all very deep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to make either of us cry before work today.
That's right.
So, John, just give me, so there's a more than a handful of really cool stories in here. I could probably close my eyes and point to many that are worth it, but the ones at the end are always resonate. The football coach one about the tornado and the murder. Mm-hmm. And then they heard the helicopter go down and then they prayed. Like, I don't know if that's biting off too much and we can chew, but there's two stories right there that are just.
Yeah. Okay. I like those two a lot. So.
Well, I mean, tell me. Yeah. Well, of course, they're yours, but you
like,
didn't
I
get.
Do like those.
Yeah. So give me what could a reader expect on one of those stories? The football coach one, what happened there?
Yeah, the football coach one was, there was a tornado in Iowa, the biggest tornado they had seen in a decade or more in Parkersburg, Iowa. And it really scrubbed and destroyed about 2/3 or 3/4 of this little town and killed 12 or 13 people. And among those who survived was a football coach who was a pretty well-known football coach, had won state championships, actually had a couple of kids make it to the NFL. And he basically came out of his basement to find his entire neighborhood just leveled and walked over to the high school and found the high school leveled and said, come hell or high water, we are going to play football here this fall. And so I went there a few days after the tornado to talk to him about his quest to clean up and basically be the heart and soul of the cleanup effort. Maybe not physically, but what he was trying to symbolize was our resurrection through football, because it's important here. And so I wrote that story and went back in the fall when they did get the football team back together. The school was under construction. The football field had been totally replaced. Grandstands had been destroyed. The scoreboard had been destroyed. And weirdly enough, the turf of the field itself had been destroyed because all the pieces of lumber from the houses and stuff had pierced it like javelins. And it made it unusable. So they couldn't even just snap them off. They had to like really dig it all up and put a new brand new field into it. And so that fall they played a game and it was very therapeutic. People said, yes, we're all still building our houses. We're all still trying to recover, but football is back. And then about a year later, and I thought that would be the end of it. About a year later, I can remember exactly where I was. I got a call. He had been in the little temporary weight room during the off-season workouts, such as they are for high school kids, but in a little temporary building in a weight room on an early weekday morning with a few kids, talking to them, helping them out with their weights and stuff. And a former player who had graduated a year or two before walked in with a gun and for some inexplicable reason, shot and killed Ed Thomas. And so I went back to Parkersburg for a third time to write about the murder of Ed Thomas and the weird and fascinating relationship between the Ed Thomas family and the family of the murderer. They were friends. They went to church together. things that can only probably happen in a small town. And so those, that trilogy, that unplanned trilogy, really sticks with me because it was really a tragedy, a story of hope, and then a story of a murder. That you know, some of these stories are series that were kind of planned out. This one was not a planned series.
It's like in our tragedies, in our darkest moments, we like there's this opportunity to kind of define ourselves, and this football coach was wow, man. I mean, what an amazing human being. And then it's the randomness of it all. It's, I guess we can control how we feel inside, but we sure as hell can't control the outside. You know, there's a tornado and then a kid with a gun. It's like, right.
Well, I mean, what are the odds of being in the two places like that? Most
Pretty
of us will
fun.
Never think close to those things. Yeah.
But nowadays, I think it was 2 or 3 weekends ago, a friend of mine said to me, I read somewhere in the news that this weekend alone, there were 12 mass shootings. And a mass shooting, I think, is 4 people have to die. This weekend.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Yeah, I think by definition, it's 4 people are injured.
Okay.
So I doubt there were 12 mass, four.
Okay,
people.
So.
But to your point, there have been dozens of mass killings, which are 4 or more, or I don't know the exact number. I shouldn't say that. But it's staggering. It's gotten to the point. You know, one of the first stories I covered that was maybe part of this kind of genre was I was a sports writer in Denver when Columbine happened. And I picked up from a Colorado Avalanche practice that day, some sort of shooting at a school. I know exactly where that is. I used to live right over there. I know my way around over there. I rushed to it, and it was the Columbine shooting. And if you would have told me back in 1999, in April of 1999, that this would be such a regular thing that we couldn't even keep track of them, that we couldn't even remember them. That since Columbine, there have been so many, we just have sort of lost track. Even this year, I bet you nobody in this country could name all the mass killings in this country.
No way.
You know, and where they've been. I couldn't. And it's just because it's become so normal.
I coincidentally, I know exactly where I was when I heard about Columbine. I was at Everest Base Camp, and Jake Norton got an email.
Oh my gosh, 1999, April 1999.
That's right. Yeah. And Jake Norton, who's a Colorado guy, originally from Massachusetts, he's like, oh my God, guys, listen. And he read the email, and we just, like, this, really? This is, come on, like, this can't be true. You know, it's... but yeah, times have changed. I think John, probably the thing I love about your book, and I've read, you know, collection, if you, I don't even know what would you call it? Like a collection book of articles, Krakauer did one that I thought was really good. And this has heart. There's a lot of heart and soul in this, and you are able to, without getting fancy and a lot of words that people have to actually go to the dictionary and look up, which I actually enjoy, like Frederick Exley and things like that. But you don't have to do that. And you feel after when you're done with the article and they're great bite-sized chunks, it's like, oh, I feel a little bit closer to humanity. I mean that.
You did that.
Thank you. I'll take that as a great compliment. Thank you.
Absolutely.
And I'm not smart enough to use bigger words, frankly. And and also, you know, as a newspaper reporter, you can't get too flowery. So I
totally.
Just try to write what I see, write what I know.
What are you working on now before I say goodbye? Any cool stories that you're on now, scoops or, you know?
No real scoops, but the Olympics are coming up. And so I've always covered the Olympics, and I'm headed to Tokyo again, as long as they'll have the Olympics and as long as they'll continue to have media, I guess. And so I'm working on a lot of stories ahead of the Olympics.
Amazing. That's fun. That's fun. We will live vicariously through you. John, you are awesome. I could probably talk to you for a long, long time. And I hope that we can soon reconnect, because I kind of want to ask you a bunch of other questions, but your time means a lot to me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's always good to see you, and I'm a big fan, so thank you.
Okay, so I did a bit of research after my conversation with John, just in time, right afterwards. We were discussing mass shootings, if you'll recall. And the most accepted definition of a mass shooting is as a single incident in which four or more people are shot or killed. In the weekend before I spoke with John, including the dates of June 4th to the 7th, there were 12 mass shootings and more than a dozen deaths in those 12 mass shootings. That's a bit of news I'm not pleased about, and perhaps one day we can find a way to discuss that here on the HQ.
Happiness Jones.
John Branch's incredible and super engaging book is called Side Country, Tales of Death and Life from the Backroads of Sports. If you'd like to buy a copy, you can visit www.norton.com or head to Amazon. John is on Twitter at JohnBranchNYT, and you, of course, can read his works in the New York Times online or in The Real Thing.
That old dragon, but it comes back.
John, safe travels to Japan for the Olympics. You're the envy of many, but you've earned your place as one of America's best journalists. Bring home another Pulitzer, John. We are rooting for you. In the show notes, I'll have a list of the stories you can find in Side Country.
Yeah,
thank you to the Wood Brothers and their management for the use of their song Happiness Jones for our theme song here on the HQ, and to their publicist Kevin Calabro for helping make it all happen. For more information about me, Tom Dharma Pollard, to inquire about personal coaching, public speaking, in person or virtually, please visit me at eyesopenproductions.com and write me anytime at tom.dharma.pollard@gmail.com, especially if you'd like to join my mailing list. If you'd like a free downloadable PDF of the Happiness Quotients, a course in happiness, visit me at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient. Thank you for visiting the Happiness Quotient. I will see you all real soon.
All of those words I wrote in the storm to rock my boat. All that was stuck in my throat when I was happy. And all of those songs I was singing, hey, while my boat was sinking. And next thing I'm thinking, I'm happy. I might as well change my name to Happiness Jones, my friend. Happiness Jones.